down in about...
We're receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 548.JL0202, certificate number 31297, the Great Idaho Beaver Drop.
You know, I like talking about wild animals and ecology and the American West.
You'll never shut up about it.
Yep.
Yeah, they're reintroducing the wolves.
Yep.
Fine, we get it.
Yep. That's right. That's basically being my friend.
You've got those big wolves airbrushed on your van. You've got like, that.
Ken, have you seen the latest salmon statistics? You're like, oh God, more salmon statistics.
No, I say, yeah, I've already seen them.
Yeah, that's
Let's
true.
Discuss.
That's true. We're both on this all the same salmon alert emails.
That's correct. My son gave, we wanted the kids to like get more into the idea of like donation and nonprofits. So every year at Christmas, we're like, hey, what are you guys into? And a couple of years ago, my son was fishing and he was like, salmon conservation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we gave a lot of money to some Coho King salmon nonprofit or some regional place. And then that means every year I get emails from Long Live the Kings all December. Hey, we need you. The salmon needs you, buddy.
They do.
I should have set up a shell corporation to give to the salmon.
They're out there crying your name.
We can't have sex without Ken. Help us spawn.
We were just talking about you setting up some kind of office outside of your kitchen where you would
office
have...
Office outside my kitchen? like hanging out the window?
No.
By the flower pots?
Not like a cantilevered office.
Okay.
No, but like I think you do most of your business there at your spacious kitchen counter. Oh, I know. You have an office in your house with a desk and everything.
I don't have my dream, which is one of those ladders that goes along the bookshelves. That's what I always wanted as a kid.
Yeah. How do you get to the top of the bookshelves?
I don't.
Oh.
I just, if I read a book and I'm like, this book sucked, it goes
Put
up
it
top.
Up there. Just throw it from the ground.
Because I'm never going to get a lot. Yeah, because I have no other way to get it up there.
Well, no, I mean that, you know, now that you are, now that you're the sole host of Jeopardy, as I long predicted.
All your work in the shadows has paid
right.
off.
I think now in LA, you need to rent like an office and install one or two people there to handle all your charitable donations, right? And to schedule your travel and...
Yeah. Like it's like the Curb Your Enthusiasm thing. There'd be a movie poster behind mm-hmm. my desk.
Mm-hmm.
I'm never there. The receptionist dislikes me.
Yeah, it's like Tony Soprano's office in the back of the tire warehouse.
Exactly.
Or the
strip club.
Yeah, he's got offices everywhere. And you go in like once a week or something just to keep the feds.
I'm going to set up a fake like Van Nuys looking strip mall here in Seattle. Like I'm a Nathan Fielder sketch where, so I can feel like I'm in LA or I feel like I'm in the valley, but I don't actually have to get on a plane. But it's got all the bleakness of one of those places, and I'll just put it in Des Moines or something.
I was thinking, hey, Des Moines is a lovely little town, although you're right, it is kind of like some weird California backwater up by San Luis Obispo. But no, I was thinking that you would get an office in the valley.
But it's so far.
But then you'd put people in it to do your work so you wouldn't have to go. You wouldn't have to spend any more time in the valley than you needed.
To do my dirty work.
Yeah.
Except in like, this case, my dirty work is like extremely virtuous and giving to the Coho salmon.
Exactly. You're like, look, I can't keep all these salmon donations straight. Can you guys?
My head is swimming with salmon that are also swimming.
Here's a binder of salmon. Now you straighten it out.
I've set up a list of my top 30 salmon priorities. Please follow these guidelines.
Max out my credit cards every month, keeping these salmon like flourishing.
Keeping them doing it.
Yeah. But do you remember, have you always been a conservationist? Have you always been like a Western guy who thinks about the rivers and the mountains? Or was there a kind of, was there a point at which that became there was some galvanizing moment?
I mean, it's a little confused for me because I became an Eastern guy. You know, I
In Asia.
I moved to Korea and opened my mind up to mystical and non-Western thought and non-traditional remedies. A lot of herbs in the third grade.
Uh-huh. Gangnam style.
But that means when I did kind of butt up against kind of the 80s iteration of the ecological movement, like, which was largely, I think, endangered species at the time. That's what it was.
These, clean water, clean air.
These poor seals. I mean, clean water, clean air might be more of a...
That's a Nixon.
Yeah. You're a little older than me, so you're like... So I do remember the acid rain stuff, but it was a lot of Time magazine covers about specific species.
Yeah.
Oh, the bald eagle. Oh, the gray wolf, the timber wolf.
Right.
And so I remember a lot of that, but it wasn't mediated by, and I live in the West and we must protect these beautiful mountains and watersheds. It really seemed a little more global. It was like, well, National Geographic will tell me who's suffering in the Himalayas and what animals are in trouble in the Sahel.
Yeah.
So it seemed pretty global to me. But I do remember having a fourth grade teacher who was very gung-ho about the earth. And really, maybe terrifying, a classroom full of kids every year about mass extinctions and stuff. And don't get me wrong, correctly terrifying.
Yeah. No.
Prophetically terrifying.
Yeah, everybody, everything's dying, yes.
But that was like my awareness of it, fourth grade me.
You know, I because my dad and uncles were all, I guess, arguably a generation older than a lot of my friends, right? Yeah. My dad was born in 21 and his brother, my Uncle Jack, 26, my Uncle Cal, 24, you know, they were...
Not just older than your friends' apostrophe.
Older than my friends' apostrophe, yeah. I mean, my parents...
I assume they were also older than your friends.
They were much older than my friends.
That's good.
But they were, you know, I have friends now whose grandparents are younger than my dad and so forth. And they grew up in a Northwest where being a lumberjack was considered, was a, you know, a hale and hearty...
That's outdoorsy.
Honorable... outdoorsy profession. And then growing up in Alaska during that era where, you know, resource extraction of all kinds was considered one of the, you know, the noblest ways to interact with the environment. Like, go there and chop it down and dig it up.
And that's what it wants.
And it stems from a time when it seemed like the outdoors was still unlimited. Right? I mean, how would you ever reach the limits of Alaska?
In Alaska, that's an easier illusion to maintain.
But even Western Washington, I mean, at the time when my dad was a teenager, it didn't seem like you could ever cut the forests down, right? You could work all day and night for 1,000 years, but, you know, they were cutting it down with saws. And then industrialization.
Nobody predicted that we would get so much better at cutting down the forest.
That's right.
You got a plan on, practice making perfect.
But my Uncle Cal was a lumberman, right? And became an executive in lumber. And so was really, and an executive during that era when it was like, let's get as much lumber out of these forests before the hippies figure it out.
I was about to say, yeah, before the government realizes.
Yeah. And so... So there, I did see a transformation happen in that generation where my Uncle Cal was absolutely trying to strip the land, and my dad and Uncle Jack were gradually becoming aware, becoming radicalized.
They were following behind him with seedlings.
Or at least following behind him with consternation and like, you know, like some, there were a few Christmas dinners that got a little heated because these, what at the time, 70-year-old men were arguing about the forests.
Early spotted owl conversations.
Yeah. And even pre-spotted owl, but I became, and then all of a sudden there was this distinction between that kind of Boy Scout hiking that involved cutting trees down with your pocket knife And this new idea of hiking that where you were meant to leave the land as you had found it.
Leave no trace.
And that was a, you know, that was a big change. And then we started to really understand, like, oh, why aren't there any salmon anymore? We built all these dams. And why aren't there any bald eagles anymore? We used all this pesticide. I mean, obviously, that started in the 60s, right? And I've been meaning to do a Silent Spring episode for a long time.
It's got to be coming.
Because
that's the kind of omnibus-like watershed that we like. Although maybe that one's so well-known that it's not quite memory hold yet.
Yeah, but we can, like a lot of omnibus, we can go far afield from it.
We can just kill an hour. Like, I don't mind wasting your time, but like, you know, 20,000 people might be listening right now. I'm wasting their time too. It's amazing.
50,000 people are feeling their time wasted.
They're not listening to the show, but they can sense the person next to them on the bus is having their time wasted.
Yeah, or it's their spouse. Oh, or they're, yeah, exactly. Like, hey, honey, honey.
They're not even talking about Idaho beavers yet. Can we skip this part?
But also, so then, as you were saying, right, in the 90s in particular, there were all those arguments between people that were reintroducing the wolves and people that immediately were setting up gun blinds to kill the reintroduced wolves. You know,
The second group was mostly ranchers.
Yeah.
They were just interested parties.
And that's true to this day, although only 2% of our foodstuffs comes from ranching on public land.
Hmm.
It remains, that public land component remains very contentious.
But that's, you're saying that's just a tiny wedge. Like that's...
It's not where the
bulk,
food comes
the bulk
from.
Of ranching is from...
Yeah.
Land owned by the ranchers.
That's right. I mean, all those hee-haws that are out in eastern Oregon fighting the government are, I mean, how many sheeps and cows are they bringing to market?
Well, yeah, when you do a symbolic struggle, it's always good to pick the dumbest possible cause.
Yeah, there you go.
Don't pick anything good for your symbolic struggle.
And the argument about reintroducing wolves and, as we'll see, beavers and many other things is not that, it's not a public land argument. Their claim is that those wolves, of course, don't respect fences or borders.
And or anything.
That's right.
Here's a list of things wolves respect.
They're so rude.
Nothing.
Food chain.
The empty set.
They respect the food chain by force.
Yeah, I'm not, I don't think they chose that. They're like, well, I guess I'll just die. I can't find a marmot.
Who knows what the wolves, I mean, yeah, will the wolves survive?
Maybe they're philosophical.
As the great 80s hit goes. The Great American Whale. Sorry, those were minor hits.
I was like, this is not Hungry Like a Wolf. What is this? I am now out of 80s wolf tunes.
But the beaver, as we've talked, we've done shows on the American beaver.
Yeah, on their anal glands in specific. Right. Like, typically, we dance around a topic, and usually we begin right at the anus.
I like that you made a ramp-up gesture with your hand, like, and... Right up the anus.
Right up the beaver.
But as we here in the United States kind of know, the beaver, chasing the beaver, I guess, is going to be the title of my autobiography.
A lifelong pursuit.
Also, what really colonized the West. I mean, that's what brought trappers and mountain men and then the settlers that followed in their wake was this pursuit of the beaver.
And a stupid fashion trend, right? That if you don't have a hat made of beaver pelt, what even are you?
Right.
Or get the hell out of Paris.
Perfume made of castor
right.
glands.
Yeah, this was all in the Castorian entry, I remember.
But you know that there was a Eurasian beaver.
What?
Yes.
I thought it was like a skunk, like only we had
the
beaver.
No, the beaver is the second largest rodent in the world.
After the capybara of South America.
Capybara, capybara, capybara.
Is this also an 80s song? Oh, you're doing Rock Me Amadeus.
No, but there is this wonderful capybara song that I'm sure is a South American band.
Every child in Brazil grows up singing the capybara song.
And the lyrics are only capybara, 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 capybara.
But that's
capybara.
Just Rock Me Amadeus. Well, capybara, capybara, I mean, capybara. In 1804, the capybara was born in Vienna.
I don't quite have the melody of the capybara song right, or the rhythm. But when you hear it, it's really an earworm.
I must never hear it then.
So, and no, don't. Yourself a favor. But the beaver was widespread across all of Europe from Russia to Scotland.
It just looks like ours. Big teeth, dam building, flat tail.
Here's what's crazy. It looks really like the North American beaver, but
it's wearing a little Scottish tam.
Get this. I know that you are an amateur geneticist.
Oh, for sure. But not in a creepy, not in an evil eugenic way.
The North American beaver has 40 chromosomes.
Congrats.
The Eurasian beaver, although it looks just like the North American beaver, has 48 chromosomes.
I don't even know where to begin. Is that good?
Well, the difference between a human and a chimpanzee is only 2 chromosomes.
So this is like a super beaver. This is like shin beaver.
So many, it's so different genetically that the two beavers cannot interbreed.
Hmm.
They're...
Well, there's also the Atlantic Ocean.
They probably try. Well, you would think, but there have been experiments releasing. Well, so, and I should explain, by the end of the 18th century,
the beaver boom.
The beavers were extirpated from all of Europe. They were down to like 1,000 beavers
huddling together in Siberia somewhere.
And so, I mean, part of the like big push in North America was that they'd already made all the hats out. I can't imagine how many hats it must have been to take 200 million beavers off the surface of the earth.
It's like you're imagining one of those giant bison herds or those passenger pigeon flocks that would block the sky for days, but then they all kind of turn into hats.
Yeah, right.
What happened? What happened to those hundreds of millions of hats?
I mean, I guess
landfills?
Killing all the buffalo and the passenger pigeon where they didn't use them at all and they just shot them for fun.
Right.
At least the beaver, it seems like
then they would just rot away. But in this case, what do you do with your tens of millions of surplus hats? Were people buried with them? I want to go around Europe digging up the hats.
Yeah, well, and they had little bells on them, so
Right.
But no, I mean, when you look at old etchings of the fashions of the time, it's not like they're all wearing Davy Crockett hats. I don't see that much beaver, although I guess it's shaved beaver.
Is it though?
Yeah, I mean, they didn't use big fur. They used groomed,
right,
beaver
like
fur.
The top hat,
yeah,
you know, with its shiny black patina or whatever. Is that's just beaver skin?
It's
right?
Beaver, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why you would need that to be beaver, but yeah, when you look at beaver hats in pictures, they do just look like a bank employee's Victorian or Edwardian top hat.
I like that you say, why does that have to be beaver?
Yeah.
That's not the question we ask in fashion. Does that have to be beaver? No. You're not getting it at all.
But wouldn't it be cheaper if it were? Yes, that's why we don't do it.
So beaver were completely like mown down in Europe and then mown down in the United States or in North America, right?
Europeans did not learn from their mistakes.
No.
When they colonized.
And one of the reasons that beaver are considered a fair game is that they do act as pests if you're trying to use the land, you know, groom the land, use it for farms, use it for orchards, because beaver come along and do beaver things.
Unlike most of our animal neighbors, they are also, like us, trying to build.
Yes, and trying to colonize and
problematic
and change the land, right? That's their goal, is to transform the land, terraform.
Into a pond.
As much as we.
If like, we just want planet Earth to be a big strip mall in Van Nuys where we can...
Yeah.
Get like, you know, decently priced sushi. But the beavers want the planet Earth to be a nice pond. The whole thing.
Yeah. We come to a place called Thousand Oaks and we chop down 900 of the oaks and you know, we put them against the culverts and then our native concrete arrives.
We go to Twin Pines Mall. We run over one of the pines with our DeLorean. We rename it Lone Pine Mall.
I only saw that just the other day. Did you just become aware of that too?
No, I'm...
You knew that.
I knew all the lore.
Oh, you're such a nerd.
Back in 85. Long conversations about Lone Pine Mall and...
The thing is, you couldn't like stop it and look at it at the movie theater.
I know.
How could you put this together?
Well, we had VHS.
I see,
we
were VHS.
I think that might have... And this has nothing to do with... Literally nothing to do with beavers. But I do think that changed art, the fact that people could pause, examine, rewatch.
Find all the little Easter eggs.
I'm still trying to figure out how to do an omnibus about this, about how our critical faculties as a people just broke.
Do you think there are Easter eggs in like bringing up baby, or were Easter eggs a development?
The ones in the old movies are like, we hope nobody catches. It's like a game with the censor. Like, hope nobody catches this, and we expect them not to.
We're going to be making out, and then the waves are going to go over us, and then the camera's going to pan, and a train will go through a tunnel.
But Back to the Future, maybe that's the urtext on VHS, people are going to love this.
Yeah, that's a hilarious joke.
You're not ready for it, but your kids with Blu-rays are going to love it.
You just made a Back to the Future joke within a Back to the Future joke.
Yes. Wow. It's Zemeckisception.
It's Back to the Futures all the way down.
That's correct. So sorry, let's get back to the Beavers and not to my argument with internet film critics.
Well, so Beavers and people, depending on how people are prioritizing the use of land for much of...
We don't want ponds.
We don't want ponds.
We like them. We don't want them everywhere. Yeah. They get our boots muddy.
Yeah, what are ponds good for? Not much. Ducks. I mean, if you're a member of Ducks Unlimited...
Or if you're feeding the ducks.
Why would you feed them if not to then kill them?
I see.
That's the whole human way.
I would toss bread because I'm
Oh, because you're looking for a way to give away your money.
No.
You'd call up your staff down in Van Nuys and say, hey, find a way to feed the ducks.
I think bread is actually not good for ducks.
No.
You're supposed to give them frozen peas.
Bread's not really good for us.
No, it's not good for anybody.
Well, you cut a hole in the ice and you put the peas around the ice. And then when the ducks come to take a pee, you kick them in the ice.
Did you know 2 out of 3 omnibus entries now have that joke for some reason? That no one understands or wants?
You don't know of what I'm going to say are the 50,000 people listening to this show. I bet you 1,500 of them want to hear that ice hole joke
every show. Every
yeah.
show.
Yeah.
Because you're like a traveling salesman from 1960 era.
Think about, you know, in any group of, because what is 50,000 people? It's a stadium full of people, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't that a football stadium full of people? Mm-hmm. You don't think you can find 1,500 of them that want to hear almost anything?
Imagine them all listening to a podcast. Like politely.
I know.
Sitting quietly. They've already got their concessions. The podcast plays over the Jumbotron.
Oh, no. I thought they all had headphones.
Oh, they all had, yeah.
It's just silence in there.
Why would they come if they could just listen in their headphones?
You tell me.
I don't know.
Haven't you seen one of those dance, like, what were those things called when everybody suddenly appeared? Flash mob. Like a dance flash mob, but they all have headphones on?
It's so rare to do a flash mob in a stadium.
Yeah.
Because how do you get in?
You're all standing at the turnstile like, we're not doing anything.
Usually if there's a flash mob in a stadium, it's because a Latin American dictator is doing something terrible, and you do not want to be in that stadium. It's a compulsory flash mob.
Yeah, all those green Ford Falcons show up at once. So there was, in addition to the fur hats, there as the Western United States was being developed as farm and ranch country, beavers, the remaining few beavers, were considered pests, and that I think was true in Europe too. I mean, a beaver is really driven primarily to, you know, to make a pond, right? Because the beaver survives by having the door to its den underwater.
That's the only reason it wants a pond? To keep predators out of its den?
It wants a pond for a lot of reasons.
Does it eat things in the pond? Yeah, probably,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's going to want fish and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, it sees its...
Currently Googling what beavers eat.
It sees its job as creating ponds.
But what's the evolutionary advantage?
Does it eat milfoil?
It does eat herbaceous plants, grasses, aquatic plants. So it does eat some, but it also just eats the twigs of the trees it's chopping up.
Yeah.
It's not like it's looking for fish.
It's one of those instances where God has created an automaton to... because they're a keystone species. You know, beavers are massively beneficial to the whole biosphere.
For what? Helping chew up forests? Like helping recycle?
Well, no. I mean, what they do, what you'll see when a beaver population is active in the wilderness, you get... like high water tables, so water is conserved within the environment, right?
I see.
You get I mean, they create wetlands that control flash floods.
Keeps water just from running back to the ocean.
And then, you know, a massive explosion in biodiversity happens. There are 2% of the land is a riparian environment, which is, you know, a swampy
river base.
2% of the land is riparian. 70% of the species live in that environment.
Beavers making it possible.
Beavers are making it possible. In fact, when they talk about reintroducing species as a way of rewilding the West or rewilding any area that has been overdeveloped, they talk about introducing two species, the gray wolf and the beaver. That's all you need.
Breeding pair.
They
have little wolver kids.
Want to bring nature back? Some wolves and some beavers. The beavers, they create a world where
wetlands.
You've got otter, you've got mink and musk creatures.
The beavers are just playing Minecraft. They're like, let's make the area look like this.
All the birds, all the things, they all show up, and then the wolves kill them.
And, it's the circle of life.
And there it is. And then they all die, and then the wolves die, and then the beavers come back.
Are salmon going to come up again? Because yes. Salmon don't like beaver dams.
They do, because salmon find it very easy to go over beaver dams.
Oh.
And then the beavers have created this wonderful salmon sex party zone up there. You know, like salmon.
Those beavers are freaks.
Yeah.
They're just sitting watching.
Beavers create habitat for everything, right? They're part of the natural world.
Well, were you following the news up in Carkeek Park this fall where a beaver has built like a massive 50-foot dam or maybe a beaver family down in those wetlands by the beach?
Oh, yeah.
And it's now so big that it encompasses a park bench. Like the boardwalk there is now underwater. Very, very busy beavers, you know, as you would expect.
Mm-hmm. It's right there in the name.
But there, because that's like the only salmon path in this kind of paved area of North Seattle, there's a little more concern about what will the salmon do? How will they get around this?
This is what happens when human beings start to try and micromanage.
Pave everything.
Right? And then here we are in Seattle, a liberal paradise, a bunch of hippies who are like, we can't tear down the beaver dam because beavers, but at the same time, we have to tear down the beaver dam
because of the salmon.
What about the salmon that we otherwise killed everywhere with our hydroelectric dams? But we have to have hydroelectric dams because otherwise you have to burn fossil fuels to make power. But we have to, you know, it's just like on and on.
The only answer is suicide. All good Seattle eco-liberals just need to walk into the sea.
Just walk into the sea. It's not a violent suicide. It's a very calm, passive.
And think of all the little squids and remora that we'll get to feed on. That's
exactly right. What do you think clams eat, if not dead hippies?
I want gooey ducks to eat me.
And so but what you're describing is a thing that conservationists have really had to kind of argue out. Like, how do we determine what of this to, how do you prioritize which animal? And I think the discovery that
cuteness, clearly.
That's right. I think that did motivate people for a long time. But realizing that how important the beaver ponds are to creating true wildness, I think is something we've been discovering, uncovering over time.
Well, we had a guy on Jeopardy the other day who I remembered in his first appearance had told me he was like an Idaho salmon conservation guy. And so I remembered what I'd been hearing about the beaver and the salmon battle up in North Seattle. And so I asked him, I think I might have asked him on the show. Like, I just commandeered the interview and was like, I know we're supposed to be playing a game show, but tell me, what do we do about this beaver dam? Should I go blow up this beaver dam? And he luckily stopped me from a life of eco-terrorism and monkey wrench ganging my life by blowing up this beaver dam. He was like, no, just leave it be. The beaver and the salmon have to figure it out. That's what's always happened in the past.
Yeah.
So he was he advised peace.
One of the things that they've discovered is that, it's clear, right? The beaver does not like flowing water. And if the beaver detects any flowing water, it's really driven to plug the hole.
Because he knows that's a leak and that could be trouble, right? That's just evolutionary. Yep. If this guy wants a pond, he wants stagnant water.
And what's been a problem for a long time is that a beaver will show up in an environment and the water, there's humans there, and the water is directed through a culvert. Mm. And the beaver targets the culvert. So it doesn't have to build a dam. There's a road there already. It just plugs the culvert.
He's loving this. It's like, this is his easiest dam ever. I'll be done by 6 o'clock.
But then everybody shows up and the water is, you know, the road is covered with water. And they're like, we got to unplug this culvert.
The eternal struggle, beavers versus culverts.
The beaver shows up, you know, that night and is just like, what happened here? Plugs the culvert again. And as we'll see, you know, now we've developed, there's enough understanding of what a beaver wants, which is also going to be, that's the first chapter of my autobiography, what a beaver wants to now understand, like, how do we manage the beaver's fever, right? The fever for the flavor of a Pringle.
Is that what it's called, beaver fever?
Beaver fever. No, that's a different thing.
I see. I feel running water and I just got to make a dam.
Beaver fever is what keeps you from drinking water out of a stream. That's Giardia.
Oh, I thought that was deer. Beaver get Giardia too?
In Alaska, we called it beaver fever. I don't know if you call it deer fever somewhere else.
I just thought it was deer poop.
No, it's all beaver poop.
Beaver poop.
In streams, if you go high enough up into the mountain above the tree line and you can see the stream from where it's popping out to where it is, you can generally drink
it. You just have to have a line of sight that no beaver is like in the middle of pooping as you're drinking.
No, and the amount of bear poop that's going to be causing a problem for you is fairly minimal, right? The bears don't like intentionally poop in the stream.
Well, I would be honored to drink bear poop, honestly.
Yeah, sure.
Like it's a majestic animal.
That might be your foundation story. Like, how did Ken get these powers?
Radioactive bear poop.
But to go back to the beaver and to describe our story, in the immediate aftermath, because there's another thing that we love here on Omnibus, and by we I mean me, I love it on Omnibus, is to talk about World War II and the mid-century culture in the United States. And right after the war, I don't know if we can ever properly understand, because that whole generation, of course, now is dying. There are hardly any left.
World War II veterans. I was watching the World War II, the Ken Burns World War II thing, and realizing, good thing he made this like in 1999 or 2006 or whatever it was, because he's got like smart, able-bodied academics who are like, well, when we got to Saipan, and I was like, today, none of those people are alive.
No, they're all 104.
A few of them are still alive and they're like, what's Saipan? People love it when you do your old person voice.
Oh, geez, what the hell? But in 1948, what you had in the United States and in the American West especially, were all these recent veterans who were in their mid-20s, who had these incredible experiences they would never be able to duplicate.
Or talk about with their families.
Never talk about with their families.
Horrifying things they had seen and done.
And weirdly, they were all pilots and could drive jeeps and could repair ships. I mean, they were very mechanically capable generation.
We took these kids out of the soda fountains and it's the last generation in America that could do things.
We're not going to keep them down on the farm now. No. And we still had what was largely an unexplored, there were huge areas that were unexplored and untrammeled in the American West.
And we decided to trammel them.
Let's trammel
them. These are the guys to trammel them. We got a bunch of extra jeeps.
Let's bombed do some Berlin trammeling. And look what, you know, we kicked Hitler's butt. Now let's kick the beaver's butts.
Next up, Idaho.
And so Idaho, right at the turn of the century, around 1900, we had really destroyed all the beaver in the United States. There were hardly any left. And throughout the middle part of the 20th century, there was a recognition that having extirpated all of the beaver, that was maybe not the greatest plan.
And we were not really hunting them for anything. It was more like, these guys are pests.
We got used to hunting beaver. Seemed like a thing, right?
Just a habit. I just got up and killed six beaver today before I even thought about it.
What do you want to do today? So after the war, there was this generation of people that started moving into, was the dawn of the water skiing culture too, right? People they all have houses and washing machines and they're going on vacation and we're expanding into what had formerly been very rural country and building vacation houses.
People have kids and cars for the first time.
Yeah.
In the past, you would have a kid or you would have a car. After the war?
You had both.
Bajillions of people with both.
Kids and cars. And in central Idaho, there's a town called McCall, Idaho, which anyone listening to this program that isn't currently living in McCall, Idaho, is going to think McCall, Idaho is absolutely BFE, which, as longtime listeners to the program know, stands for Bum Egypt. And it really is. It's in the middle of Idaho. The nearest big city is Boise, and the word big in relation to Boise is also in italics.
Boise is huge.
Big
asterisk
city.
By Idaho standards. I've never been to McCall. I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah,
it's not. You're right. It's not on the way to anywhere.
No, if you were in Clarkston, maybe McCall would be where you wanted to go. But anyway, McCall was experiencing a wave of development. People were arriving in McCall and building houses, and it was like, hey, McCall, Idaho, it's the new Lake Tahoe. It's the Lake Tahoe of central Idaho. And, you know, central Idaho is one of the least roaded areas in the United States. It's absolutely a wilderness, not accessible, really.
And much of it very beautiful.
Incredibly beautiful. And incredibly beautiful, and its inaccessibility means that most Americans will never fully appreciate, like, the great bounty of northern Idaho. I mean, far northern Idaho has I-90 going across it and is full of white supremacists.
That's the only part I've ever been, yeah. But the part between Lewiston and Missoula.
But central Idaho, you know, north of Sun Valley and south of...
Yeah, all the money stops at Sun Valley.
Yeah. Anyway, McCall was booming, and beavers were a problem. Beavers were doing their beaver stuff, and people in McCall were like, hey, we got to get rid of these beavers. But there were now ecologists saying, look, we can't just kill beavers anymore. And there had been programs... relocating problem beavers had been a thing that people were trying to do all the time.
Like, instead of killing this guy, we're enlightened. Let's just get him away from this housing development.
Yeah, we're going to pick him up from this pond and we're going to take him over to that pond.
This is a little interruption, but I legitimately think my wife's family wants to go on vacation in McCall, Idaho next year.
You're kidding.
No.
Did you just search McCall on your computer?
Yeah, I'm looking at this lake and I was like, wait, isn't this the place they're thinking about renting a place?
I mean, it's really nice there.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure this is it. I may be in McCall, Idaho in 6 months against my own will.
Oh my gosh, goodness, you're going to be able to tell this story around the dinner table to all of your
Let me explain to you what happened here in the 40s.
Although Mindy listens to the show, right? So she...
Would you?
I mean, you know, I think if you got to hear Ken all the time, why would you also then listen to Ken talking to me?
To hear you.
Oh, right.
I give her I have my assistant in the valley give her an edited version of the show that's just all your part.
And then your part is turned into Charlie Brown.
I'm edited
voice.
Out. Yeah, exactly. It's a muted trumpet. I'm texting her now to say, hey, is McCall, Idaho, where we're trying to get out of that vacation with your family?
Well, wait, now your dad listens to the show. I know that for sure.
Yeah, my mom does. Your Maybe mom my does? Dad. But these would be the in-laws.
Oh, right.
Are they listening to Omnibus? Hard to say. Well, if we skip that vacation, now you know why.
I meet people all the time on the street who are like, get out of my way. And also, I listen to Omnibus. BTW.
Just some ranting homeless person. I like Omnibus.
Ranting homeless person with a mid-Atlantic accent. Hey there, you. Out of my way. Moving beaver was already a practice. But the problem is, you know, if you do it incompletely, if you just move some problem beaver, other beaver will show up almost immediately.
Somebody else is going to build a dam there in the same spot.
Because that beaver's like, whoa, look at this flowing water over here. I got to plug this hole. And also, relocating beaver any great distance is really a challenge because beaver are not small, second largest rodent, and they like to stay wet. If they dry out, they get overheated. And at the time, especially moving it into a wilderness that doesn't have roads, all you can do is put the beavers in cages and put them on the back of a mule.
And just hope they survive to their new home.
But what it turns out is that mules hate beavers.
What?
Yeah, they just don't like them.
I thought it was beavers and culverts, but no. It turns out the real enemies here.
There are a lot of things that don't like beavers, I guess, because they're kind of stinky.
I guess here's the flowchart. Mules hate beavers. Yeah. Beavers hate culverts. We just need to know what culverts hate.
Well, and also, where do humans fit into that? Humans love mules.
I do love mules.
Sort of. But mules kind of hate humans, too. Mules are pretty grouchy.
We need to find someone who hates mules. That's the top. That's the apex predator of this hate chain.
So the problem with relocating beavers out of populated areas into completely unpopulated areas where they can just beaver away and not be in anybody's way is that taking beavers across the country presents all kinds of problems.
Violation of the Mann Act.
Taking them from Missouri to Kansas, start a war.
So what do you do?
So in 1948, a naturalist by the name of Elmo Heter or Heter.
Even back then, people had
I'm sure it's
haters,
a
heaters.
It's a German name, Heter, let's call it.
Okay.
Was a, you know, kind of a young-ish, you know, World War II vet era kind of guy who was probably wearing Filson pants and had a pencil behind his ear and was out there trying to solve problems. He was a game warden and also like a pilot from the war who kind of had a brainstorm that there were a lot of surplus parachutes from World War II. The ground was thick with surplus parachutes.
He has two problems. I've got too many parachutes and too many beavers. And like weeks go by as he like looks back and forth between the two piles.
He said, what if I, obviously, you know, it should be clear to everyone listening that in this case, the solution was clearly let's parachute these beavers into the far off middle of Idaho.
I'm very interested in the logistics of just, I mean, let alone, how do you get a beaver in a parachute?
There you go, right? And that was the,
Elmo's got a new problem to solve that science has never considered.
That was the fun part, I think, for Elmo. Well, no, clearly the fun part is pushing beavers out of an airplane, but the other fun part for somebody with a mechanical inclination
is training them how to pull the ripcord.
Well, that's right. How do we throw beavers out of an airplane under a parachute and keep the beaver alive.
Also, it has to land in some... It's the idea that it will gnaw its way out of the parachute through its beaver instinct.
So that was the first idea. What if we make willow cages, put the beavers in the willow cage, and then drop them in the wilderness, and then the beaver will naturally eat its way out. But the problem was you made a willow cage, put a beaver in it, the beaver immediately started gnawing its way out.
In the air?
Yeah, right.
While it's falling?
Before you even got it to the airplane.
I see, you're on the airfield.
And so how do you make a willow cage that will hold a beaver long enough to parachute it into the wilderness?
Ah, it's like a Rube Goldberg thing.
Right, and they couldn't quite figure out, you know, the willow cage. I mean, eventually you get tired of weaving willow cages, I'm guessing. And so Elmo then devised a box, a beaver box, that had a lid that was strapped closed, but when the box hit the ground, the lid would spring open.
Ah.
And the beaver would come out. And so he tested the box with weights, and it appeared to work. But then he really needed to...
drop one from space, basically.
Really test this out. And so he captured a big old male beaver, whom he named Geronimo. And he put Geronimo in a beaver box, took him up, dropped him out. Geronimo landed. The doors sprung open.
It worked.
Everybody rejoiced. Geronimo jumped out of the box.
Geronimo's not dead.
There were a bunch of other game wardens standing there. They grabbed Geronimo, put him back in the box, and they did this over and over.
They did this 8,000 times.
They did it such
that... Just want to make sure it's reliable, because if you're going to do this to 100 beaver, let's see how many of them are going
to
make it out.
Yeah, we don't want to kill 50% of the beaver.
Right.
So they did it over and over to the point that Geronimo the box would land, the doors would open, and Geronimo would just sit in the box.
Because he was again.
Like, look, I'm not... You've fooled me once, shame on you, fool me twice.
Geronimo's like having a real teleological... You know, he's like, well, this is clearly hell.
It's Groundhog Day.
I've decided.
Except it's Beaverhog Day.
It's literally Groundhog Day.
And clearly, Elmo must have been really enjoying this game because after...
It's got to be the most fun he's ever had as a warden.
I feel like after you've established, like how many times would you drop a beaver out of a plane before you felt like your box worked?
I feel like if I went 8 or 9 out of 10, I'd be good. I'd be done. Maybe that's more than I would do, because it's a lot of effort to get a plane in the air.
Yeah, my sense was after 4, I'd be pretty confident that it was going to work.
Like as long as fewer than one failure, 1 or 0 failures, you'd go ahead with the
operation. I did it 4 times and it didn't break a single time, I'd say this beer box is a good design. So having proved its case with Geronimo, they decided they were going to go ahead with this beaver relocation program. And the first beaver they dropped out was Geronimo.
Of course.
And they decided, and I'm not going to say whether this is good or bad. I'm not going to make any assessment of this idea. But they decided that the proper ratio was 1 Geronimo to 3 comely young female beavers.
Are they dropping them in places that do not have endemic beavers? Because surely there's beavers in them. There are hills.
This is a big wilderness, and there's a lot of space because beavers. There used to be.
You want to scatter them, I guess, right?
There used to be 200 million beavers in North America.
Jeez.
And by
the human population didn't reach that until the 50s or something, right?
And so by 1948, the number of beavers that had been reintroduced into the American West was nowhere near the beaver capacity of Idaho. There were beavers.
It's a beaver drop in the bucket.
There were employment opportunities for beaver throughout the region, and so he took Geronimo and 3 lady beavers and dropped them at a lake.
It seems a little like 40s and 50s era.
Yeah, it's
gender roles.
It's like a Hugh Hefner version.
Geronimo's going to want to choose, clearly, and we don't care if two of the women kill each other.
No, I don't believe that beavers are like mating pairs. I think Geronimo is more like a Saudi prince in this.
Beavers
situation.
Are not married pairs. I guess I always assume there'd be like it's like in C.S. Lewis where there's Mr. and Mrs. Beaver living in their dam.
That's the thing.
But that's not correct.
No. It's that there are only fairly small number of mammal species are right. mating pairs.
Right. You're still fighting with me over whether human beings are.
Yeah, right. We fight about it all the time.
We've
bored so many people in elevators.
Are they bucks and does? What the hell are beavers called? Beavers do not have names for the male and female. They just have kits for the babies.
Kits for the babies. And I think comely young female is how you describe a lady beaver.
Is this the only animal that does? I thought all animals had some abstruse. When you get right down to it, they are hens and bulls, you wouldn't expect that of the marmot.
A group of beavers is just called a colony, which seems boring because that's also what
a group of anything is called.
Yeah, a colony. But they're not called a genocide of beavers or whatever.
Or something cool,
like a
gnawing of beavers.
Yeah, or a vampire bat of beavers.
But there's no name for a male and a female. We could do it now. We could come up with it now.
Male beaver, female beaver.
Beaver and beavette.
You want to call them coots and cots?
I got it. Wards and Junes.
Wards and Junes.
It's not bad.
No, that's wonderful. It's so good that you bring everything back to 50s television.
That's how I was raised. Thank you, Nickelodeon. But we invite your suggestions on what
male and female beavers should be called. I'm going to say applets and cotlets.
Which is which?
I think applets.
Applets and cotlets.
So, what's funny is that first little Geronimo and his 3 wives, the applet and cotlets of this story. The boxes open perfectly. All 3 lady beavers jump out and start like partying, and Geronimo just sits in his box.
I'm not falling for this again.
And he sits in his box for a while before he kind of pokes his head up, looks around. Hey, no ecologists here, not a single game warden. And eventually he gets out.
Well, except there must be some ecologists there, or otherwise, how do we know he waited to get out?
Well,
somebody's monitoring this.
I think it's, I think Elmo's just flying around in circles.
He's waiting.
No, the ecologists are hiking in and seeing how things are going.
There's guys with clipboards.
They proceed Elmo and his team then proceed to drop 76 beavers throughout what at the time was the Chamberlain Basin, which is just in a different part of central Idaho where there's nothing.
A more remote part.
What it now is called is the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness Area.
Oh, well, we covered this. It's a Frank Church, the guy that was traveling the world with Teddy Roosevelt and his kids?
Right.
Okay.
So, and this is an area I drove across a couple of years ago on the one highway across central Idaho.
Where is this?
And it is, and while I was there, of course, there were big forest fires everywhere.
I went to Google Maps and it's just an empty light green screen.
Yeah.
Let me pull back a little.
And yeah, still a green screen. A green screen. There's a river. Nothing. And then there's Highway 93.
There's that highway.
And
but you would never do this unless you were heading north out of Sun Valley. And it's not clear why you would be. I guess if you're going from Sun Valley to Missoula, is this closer than going over to I-15? I don't know.
Yeah, so I have done that drive from Sun Valley to Missoula. I went to Sun Valley for spring break one year with a bunch of Montana boys.
Woo, spring break.
And then after we left Ketchum, we decided to go up and go to all their different hometowns. We went to Butte. We went to Bozeman. And there was a Montana boy in our party group from each town in Montana.
Had you done this on purpose? You had recruited?
No, because we were all going to Gonzaga, and Gonzaga is basically
it's
essentially like the Catholic University
of Montana.
The smartest
Catholic boy in each Montana town gets a scholarship.
Yeah, so it was a very fun trip. But that area, the sort of Bitterroot area bounded by this few little set of highways.
I'm looking at the Idaho-Montana border here, and I'm reminded that it's very unusual in the U.S. because it is not, it wiggles back and forth on the map, but it's not a river.
It's not a river.
It's just the crest of the Bitterroots, yeah, I think.
Right. That's right. It's a continental divide.
Fun.
So it was a successful plan. They relocated 76 beavers. Only one beaver died in the entire operation.
And what was it, a fluke? Was it a suicide?
No, what happened was there was kind of a malfunction in the lid. The beaver...
It's like Apollo 1.
One of the beavers pushed his way through the lid and got on top of the box.
In the air.
And was flying on top of the box under the parachute.
He's like, I'm the apex predator. I'm the most powerful beaver on Earth.
That's right. I'm a golden god. And he really... they watched him and thought, like, this beaver is never going to be the same, right? This beaver is not going to be content just plugging culverts. And then... inexplicably, 75 feet from the ground, he jumped.
Off the box.
He was like, I'm a flying squirrel! And he fell to his untimely death.
In the beaver world, this is the myth of Icarus. Like, this is what they say. They don't say he flew too close to the sun. They say he jumped off his beaver box.
And I...
Oh, my wife confirms McCall, Idaho is the vacation.
Is the vacation spot. I can't
now,
wait
now
to
I kind of want to do it.
Well, sure. Don't get out of this... this plan. Go see why they needed the beavers gone.
I'm texting her. We are doing an omnibus on McCall, except that autocorrected to at McCall, and this is going to confuse her. There we go.
What confuses me, of course, is that that one beaver that died, he had three lady friends.
Oh, yeah.
Who were like, well, now what?
The beginning of beaver lesbian culture.
Yeah, they showed up and they were like, maybe we should open a garden supply store. It turned out that it was extremely cost-effective. It only cost $30 per beaver trip, which even in 1948 dollars was pretty reasonable. And half that cost was just buying the surplus parachutes. And they could go out and get the parachutes and bring them back. So
that's what I was wondering. Yeah. Are the parachutes still littering the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness?
No, they recycled the parachutes. So anyway, that beaver population then began to thrive, and all across the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness area, there are beaver ponds, which are
the descendants to this day
of
Operation Dambo Drop.
That's right. It's a flourishing wilderness. Now Idaho has later had a kind of unfortunate. Now we're talking about Eastern Idaho, a very different environment. And Eastern Idaho, a, strong Mormon culture there.
I was at a friend's wedding in Blackfoot once, if you have any questions about the Dairy Queens of Eastern Idaho.
Yeah, I have relatives in Malad City, which we've talked about. But over in
where Idaho begins, says the sign.
Although Idaho began quite a ways down the road from Malad City.
Yeah, like I put the sign by Woodruff.
But this is definitely the 40 acres and a mule area of Idaho. 40 acres and a mule for Mormons.
Like where Brigham Young sent the... Yeah. I don't think
the
we would
overflow.
Let's not appropriate the 40 acres and a mule.
No, that probably wasn't the plan.
Prospectors hate mules. I figured it out.
Oh.
Prospectors hate mules. Mules
hate
beavers.
Beavers hate culverts.
By the transitive property, prospectors must just hate culverts.
I'm sure they do. Yeah. Right?
Unless they're panning for gold in them.
I met a guy in Malad City named John Roderick, who was like 5'2", bow-legged cowboy, who told me a story about how he was on a cattle drive from Malad City to Bozeman in 1930. And there, you know, no roads, and he was just a boy and all this stuff. And I was just like, wow, man, it's the West out here. And he's my namesake. He's some cousin, some distant. I mean, I guess 3/4 of all Roderick males are named John.
You got to keep up with the... I always heard it as Malad.
I don't know. Malad.
You got to keep up with the Malad Rodericks. Send him a Christmas card. The Maladricks.
I went to a family reunion out there, and there were like 10,000 of them. And, you know, they're all young and beautiful.
Let's start paratrooping them into northern Idaho. There's too many Rodericks there.
Well, this happens a lot in Idaho where there are too many of a thing. And in 1981, this part of Idaho, around a wonderfully named and very apropos place name, Mud Lake, Idaho.
Sounds good.
They had been experiencing for over 100 years a boom and bust cycle of jackrabbits, and in 1980, and over the course of this 100 years, every 10 years it seemed like there was just an explosion in the jackrabbit population.
I feel like I would be okay with a jackrabbit bust. Like when jackrabbits bust, you know, people don't lose their homes.
Right.
People probably don't even notice.
Well, they do notice when there's a jackrabbit boom.
Right, because, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, jackrabbits are another pest to human beings. They eat all the corn or wheat or whatever the hell they're growing out there in eastern Idaho. And the traditional method of dealing with the jackrabbits, especially since they had killed all the wolves and coyotes, was to go out every 10 years and just have a big jackrabbit massacre where all the residents of Mud Lake...
Everybody's got a shotgun?
Well, no. They all just go out and hit them with sticks.
This is a Simpsons episode. It's whacking day.
Yeah, they tied an onion to their belts and they went out and they would, you know, the whole town would go out and they'd just kind of go through the brush in the winter and herd all the jackrabbits, which... I think in eastern Idaho are probably 4 feet tall and weigh 90 pounds.
Right. Jimmy Carter would be terrified.
They herd all these jackrabbits kind of into an area, and then they just club them to death like Canadians used to do with seals. And that had never been a problem because nobody knows what's going on out in Mud Lake. But in 1981, there was...
They made the mistake of doing it for Disney documentary cameras.
They made the mistake of doing it in an era where television news... Right. Was starved for content, and a local reporter from some Idaho television station went out and did this sort of like man on the street, like, so you're out here clubbing rabbits, and some John Roderick,
some blood covered guy,
was like, yeah, well, they eat all our wheat, and we just gotta, and so got all this footage that just looks insane, absolutely insane. It's, you know, there's 800 people out there with baseball bats.
This is our Blackfish or Faroe Islands or whatever.
Yeah, and they're just whacking these rabbits until the ground is just covered with rabbits. And I think the reporter or subsequent reporters, you know, went to these people and said, well, why don't you do it? And I think the Humane Society got involved and they said, look, we understand you got to get rid of the rabbits. Too many rabbits. But isn't there a better way than having this insane ritual?
It's not respectful of their culture.
But then there's, you know, there was some old guy that was like, well, you can't have 800 people with shotguns. That's dangerous. That's poisoning fair. Them is bad.
Fair.
It's crazy expensive to herd them all into like a truck and gas them with carbon dioxide. That's not going to work.
You can't trap them. Like, basically, the best way to do this is just hit them with sticks.
The old timer had considered all the options.
He had. And, but it became a national news story because it was a horrific image.
And it's bunny rabbits, you know?
It's bunny rabbits, even though they're
not the cute kind.
Yeah, and this there's some old timer that was like, they're basically prairie rats. Like, don't be fooled by their big ears. But so Idaho has this kind of bad reputation of deciding that, because who knows now whether the jackrabbit is really like a keystone species too, out there eating hay bales.
We're going to find out.
Well, I just feel like they're coyote food, and coyotes hate prospectors. Prospectors hate...
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, mules. But there are... To wrap up, there are a couple of other beaver reintroduction stories, or beaver introduction stories. In 1946, just before the Great Beaver Parachute Adventure, a large number of beavers were introduced into the Tierra del Fuego area in South America in... an attempt to create a fur industry in what at the time was considered just vacant, unusable land. Who's going to do anything down in Tierra del Fuego? Let's just put a bunch of beavers down there and then we can hunt them and make hats out of them. Beaver hats, not as much in fashion.
Never caught on in the Southern Hemisphere?
In the post-war world. And so the beavers just went bonkers down there because there are no wolves, there are no coyotes, there's nothing to eat a beaver. And so
it's a beaver ruled.
Beavers have exploded.
Beavetopia.
In the Tierra del Fuego, there are now over 200,000 beavers down there, and it's just like
no end in sight.
Yeah, and they're just killing everything.
You're not going to believe this, but I have slogged through the mire of beaver wetlands in Tierra del Fuego.
Really?
Yeah, we went to this Argentine state park one day. I think we were heading to Antarctica, but our boat was delayed a day, so they ferried us around the state park to see all the wildlife. And yeah, the most notable wildlife is the endless beaver infestation.
And people there talked about it as an invasive
species. Yeah, the guides were talking about, you know, they're trying to figure out how to save what should be this pristine national park from this beaver onslaught.
It just gives you a sense of how much from 1946 to the present, the idea of what is a pristine environment and how important that is has changed so much at that, you know.
It didn't occur to me that it's probably been 75 years and this has just been getting worse.
Yeah, just beavers everywhere.
So if you see a beaver... get it quick because you don't know what's going to happen in the future. It's like running down the pine tree.
Now, in Europe, there have been, since the 90s, only in recent years, in the last 20 years, starting in 2009, they started to reintroduce Eurasian beavers into Scotland. They've been introducing beavers from Russia, where beavers, you know, they could never get all the beavers. They're bringing Eurasian beavers back into Europe and dropping them in and saying, like, I don't think they're parachuting them in, but they are, and probably not mules either.
Is this what led to Brexit?
There's almost...
anger over an onslaught of Slavic beavers taking our jobs?
There are very few places, and Scotland might be one of them, where there are fewer roads than there are beavers.
Right.
And but they're putting beavers in Europe again. And
starting at Scotland.
Down in the Balkans, in Germany, there are beavers now being reintroduced into Europe, and everybody, I think, is super happy because everyone in Europe is a hippie, as we know.
Well, until they start damming all the rivers, and then we'll see how deep all this ecological fervor actually runs.
Exactly.
When your backyard is mud.
Yeah, when the water goes over the Autobahn and four BMWs careen into the culvert.
Right. See? Also, another thing that BMW drivers hate, culverts.
Culverts.
It's the thing they have in common with beavers.
There's one more story that really belongs in the omnibus. It would be its own entry if it would just wasn't so close to parachuting beavers in.
Right. You don't want to do two shows about
parachuting animals in. But there is another example of animals being parachuted in to an area. And that happened a little bit after the beaver parachute drop. And I have to imagine was influenced by it.
Okay.
But in Malaysia in 1960, the British colonial government had been spraying DDT in order to eradicate mosquitoes in Malaysia, which must have been a plague. The DDT got into the lizards because the lizards were eating mosquitoes. DDT, or they were just ingesting DDT. And then apparently there was a very large cat population in Malaysia.
Just some kind of wild jungle cat?
No, just domestic cats.
Oh, okay.
That
ate lizards.
Ate the lizards, and then the cats all died from DDT poisoning.
Were these were domesticated cats? No.
Well, they were cat, you know, just sort of. They were domestic cats that were out enough that they were eating, you know, they were rat control cats.
Yeah.
Because after the cats all died, there was an explosion of rats in this part of Malaysia. Rats, just a pestilence of rats.
Rats love DDT, it turns out.
And so the British government, in the classic example of an intervention into the ecosystem.
An intervention.
They dropped.
Come in and sit down.
They parachuted cats into Malaysia to kill the rats.
Can you imagine an animal that would like that less?
And reports vary, but there is some there's some evidence that up to 14,000 cats. Yes.
How many per shoot?
14,000 cats. I don't, you know, that's the thing. Two cats don't like being in a box together.
Is it each one with a little tiny parachute?
I can't imagine that it's one boy cat and three girl cats.
I imagine it's one guy up in the open door of a plane just, wow.
Or a helicopter. Out you go. 14,000 cats. And there's no way they could count how many cats survived, how the cats survived this parachute drop. But they dropped all these cats as rat control
and
devices.
Plenty did, even if it was just half.
I mean, I think they stopped using DDT and they repopulated Malaysia with cats.
I mean,
and you never hear about Malaysian rats now.
This is the solution to every ecological problem. Stop using the terrible pesticides and throw a bunch of cats out of an airplane.
Cats, wolves, and beavers. The keystone species.
Animals with parachutes. We love it. And that concludes The Great Idaho Beaver Drop, certificate number 31297 in the omnibus. Futurelings, don't look for us on social media. Should we parachute into Twitter and reclaim it?
No.
Once Twitter gets burned out, we're going to need to actually parachute in all the old good weird Twitter people to make a better ecosystem.
I think about
terraform
this
it for the next generation.
If Elon Musk got hit by a bolt of lightning and suddenly became sort of an altruistic, like public service believer in unlimited government,
the best kind.
What do you think? What if he was going to sign Twitter over to a public agency that was going to cultivate Twitter as a public service, like, as a public square.
Like the Wikipedia Foundation takes over Twitter.
Would it be Wikipedia? Is that, because I thought about that. Would you hand Twitter to Wikipedia? Or well, who would you give it to?
Elon wouldn't. He hates Wikipedia because it's the only part of the internet that's still working.
But this is Elon who gets hit with a bolt of lightning.
I see. Couldn't he just die and his estate does this? Or
yeah, but who is his estate? A bunch of kids that hate him. Maybe they turn it over. Do you think Twitter could be reformed if it was... given to the University of Minnesota or something, where it was like, you know, keep this going and keep the Nazis out and take ads out of it.
I think so, because Wikipedia is still good.
Right.
All you need to do is get the weird, you know, the weird billionaire and possibly his whole for-profit apparatus out of it, and then you finally get an internet that's compatible with Marxism and everybody wins.
How many moderators are there in Wikipedia?
I don't even know.
How many Wikipedia is that what they're called? Moderators?
Maybe editors? There is a status you can have.
Oh, Wikipedia does not have a group of people known as moderators, says Wikipedia.
But it does have admins, right? It has editors. Oh, but are the editors just doing their own?
Well, let's see.
They are volunteers.
A minority of users contribute. It says 122,000 have edited in the last 30 days.
But some people have to have privileges to like lock an article if there's some edit war going on over the Ukraine article. Somebody's got to have the hat that lets you lock it or whatever.
Yeah, so
there must be some hierarchy of...
I'm sure there is.
Somebody who knows a ton about this because they make 100 Wikipedia edits per day
is listening to the show right now
and is about to and is already writing an email.
Yeah.
And I encourage you to do that. I want to know.
Dear sirs,
how does this weird community work? Because it is great. I mean, it's Even Google doesn't work now, but Wikipedia still does.
I really wish we could do, if we could wave a magic wand and just take Twitter and give it to like St. Paul Public Radio or Wikipedia.
Well, when Paul Allen died, it took a few years, but we got his movie theater back.
We did.
His movie theater is back open again here.
That's one thing.
So maybe Elon will get hit by a Cybertruck at some point, and after a long legal battle, all his kids who hate him, his grown kids who now hate him, especially the trans one, will take over Twitter, and it'll be good.
Yeah.
In the meantime, you can find whatever we used to put on social media archived at Omnibus Project, or at Ken Jennings, or at John Roderick. Email was still directed to us at, is it theomnibusproject@gmail.com? That sounds right.
Yes.
And you can send us physical items to P.O. Box 55744 Shoreline, Washington. These three are all shaped like Christmas cards.
Oh, I bet they are Christmas cards.
We are in late December as we record this. We don't know what era you're in. But in our time, it was traditional to send your favorite podcast your family letter with your update.
Yeah.
Here's a picture of the Gettys.
Hi, Gettys.
Oh, and in fact, there's an honorary member of the family here. You met them in Charleston.
Oh, look at that. How cute.
Earlier this year.
Oh, they were a wonderful little family.
No family letters.
Brand new baby.
So we don't know if, George and James like playing with their play kitchen, or if Emily's thinking of going back to school, or if Hank's golf game is going well. Here's another Christmas card from the... We'll just say from Bill and Tess, but all the pictures are of their cats, Pippi and Buster.
Sure.
Who we would not ever toss out of a Malaysian airplane.
Hi, Pippi and Buster.
Tess listens to Omnibus while she trains for marathons. Little humble brag.
Good one.
Nice job, Tess.
And I wonder how Bill feels. Do you think Bill is the spouse that's like, honey? Yeah. Honey?
Are you listening to those men again? And one all the way from the United Kingdom. Somebody spent a lot on Royal Mail postage.
How much did it cost to send a letter from UK?
Well, I can't tell because apparently they've gone to a forever stamp model too, where all these things just say first, like they're three first class stamps to get this internationally.
Okay.
And then also QR codes or something. Look how
everything
their
now.
Stamp technology is ahead of ours. And this is Kevin's Christmas card, which I'm having a hard time opening.
So one first-class stamp in the UK costs £1.25. So that was an expensive. That's almost 4 pounds.
He spent almost £4. He spent over $5 to get this to us.
Well done.
And it's extremely British. It's a painting, a winter scene from the National Gallery of London. Hendrik Avercamp's 1615 canvas, A Scene on the Ice Near a Town.
Is that people skating on the Thames?
It is something, whatever the ice, the lake or the river is, has frozen and people are skating about. And Kevin's an American living abroad. I'm sorry, Kevin. It's always cool to get a little taste of home every way. I guess I'd never thought of that as Omnibus is kind of a Tokyo Rose, voice of America. I know those are not the same thing.
We're not very Tokyo Rose. Hello, GIs. You're not going to survive the war.
But it's nice. I guess we're a voice for homesick expats.
You know, I think that happens a lot. I've met expats overseas, some of them who have been living overseas for a large part of their lives, but still are very American and think and listen to podcasts from the United States.
I had never thought
featuring
about
me.
I had never, mostly you.
the most American guy.
They think of you as the representative of our culture. I had not considered how that must have changed since I was a kid, and we really had a dearth of American content.
Yeah, you were just watching Jeopardy on Armed Forces
TV. We watched whatever the Armed Forces TV put on. It would be a lot of reruns of sitcoms and stuff. And it would be, if somebody had gone home for a break or something, they might bring back a VHS tape with a bunch of SNL sketches or Wendy's commercials or something. And when we would just... Masters of the Universe cartoons. We would watch whatever it was with no discrimination whatsoever and pass it around like we were Grateful Dead fans.
Yeah, you'd pause Back to the Future every five frames.
Look, they changed the name of the mall. Write that down. We had clipboards. You can send us... it's very early, but please send us a holiday card for 2024. Mm-hmm. Do it now. They're on sale, probably still at the stores. Mm-hmm. You could find other Futurelings online on various subreddits and Facebook groups. I think there's a Discord and a something else probably. And the best way to support the show, there's lots of things you can do. Recommend it to a friend. Go leave an Apple Podcast review. Oh, have you seen, occasionally I'll look at the Apple Podcast review
of
our show.
Of our show?
And it's always a mistake. Like, here's the latest one.
A mistake to do it, you're saying?
No, it's a mistake for me to read it.
Oh, yes.
Oh, here's a new one that's nice. There's a couple new ones that are nice, but the previous one from November, used to love the show, but I could only listen to so much racism towards white people. He figured it out. The show is just a vehicle for our deep hatred of the white race.
Wow.
After listening to 200 plus episodes that I loved,
yeah,
it was hard to get past the constant degradation of all things white people have done. Literally every show has overtones of how bad white people have been and currently are. You know, guys, most of the world is not white, and all the things they have done have not been amazing. Well, so this is one of those guys who needs us to say at every point, actually, there were African tribes that did slavery with other African tribes, so it must be okay.
Yeah.
You know, the Indians used to fight, too.
You know, the only one of us that is racist against white people is you.
Oh, I hate white people.
I'm
so
100% pro-white people. That's, I mean, not pro-all white people. There are good and bad white people.
You're an ethno-nationalist, got it.
Yeah, no. You know what? Both sides can.
John, that's ridiculous. Some of my best friends are white.
I have met some of them, including me.
And they're extremely
also white.
Extremely white. I live in Seattle. So when I say some of my best friends, I mean I'm desperately trying to find any other kind of friend. Please. If you're a person of color in Seattle and you see me walking down the street, please hit me up.
Please say hello.
I need my barbecues to not be 100% white.
Yeah, I mean, as we've said many times, you and I are both the color of sand, with you being slightly pinker. A slightly pinker color of sand. You're one of those Kauai beaches, whereas I'm just sort of a regular Maui beach.
What's the difference?
Well, Kauai beaches, the sand's a little pinker.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Neither
I thought
of
you
us
meant
have
the people on
eyebrows.
The beach. You're right. They've been blasted off. If you guys could just leave that garbage out,
yeah,
the show would accomplish its stated purpose. Apparently our stated purpose is to educate about the greatness of the white race. I had no idea.
Well, it's to educate. I mean, I don't know what... It's to educate about all things.
But this guy thinks our podcast is to make the world safe for the white race and its children, apparently.
No, that he thinks that should be. We're really doing is trying to extirpate the great word of this show.
We want to put all white people in airplanes
and
toss them out with parachutes.
Into the wilderness.
To somewhere over Nunavut.
Where they can plug culverts.
What will they build out there? What do white people build left to themselves? Model railroad layouts?
Well, no. The first thing they do is kill all the beaver.
And build GameStops in the wilderness. So basically, if you disagree with Tanner Bush's take on Omnibus, this is still going to be at the top of our Apple Podcasts.
Oh, right. Reviews. It's still on it's on the reviews.
Yeah, it's like the third one people see. So they're like, oh, this show looks good. Let me scroll over. Oh, this show looks good.
Oh
this show's racist.
Oh.
Against white people.
Well,
okay.
Geez, I'm not sure. You know, it depends. Like 4 years ago, that would have been like a major compliment. Now the times are changing. Nobody knows what the hell to
no,
think anymore.
I am not a relativist. It is always good to be super racist against white people.
Oh, well, see, that's what I mean. You're
Tanner's not wrong.
You're the racist one here, not me.
So if you like Omnibus, you could leave a review on Apple Podcasts that would push Tanner to the bottom of the stack.
Yeah,
or at least leave a counter review that says, I listened to this show because of this review and I'm appalled at how little racism against white people it contains. I would prefer more.
Wait, can you do counter reviews?
you could leave a review in the stack that the average reviewer would see at the same time.
But can you reply?
There's
you
no
can't
rattle,
reply to
no,
reviews.
There's no. You can't even say I found this to be helpful.
Yeah.
It's not like Amazon. Or even better, I mean that's a fun use of 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Is to tell Apple Podcasts you like the show.
Well,
more than Tanner does.
You know, the thing is, we do teach the controversy about white people.
They do some good things, like...
The aqueduct.
You're one of these guys that thinks about Rome
the aqueduct.
A lot. I think about Rome
sanitation
several times a day. Penicillin?
Penicillin.
White guy. Yeah. So, you know, it's not all bad. I feel like we're teaching the controversy.
Sure. Steam engine.
The best steam... Well, problematic there.
Oh, I guess so. Well, the steam engine's not like 100% positive.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, right. It brought other things.
You're inviting people to imagine a world where no white guy ever invents the steam engine.
Yeah. Guns, germs, and steel. That's our...
kind of our three big things. But the best way to support the show, if you don't think writing Apple Podcast reviews is fun, is you could go to patreon.com/omnibusproject. And at this point, I think there are now exactly 50 addenda episodes. Like,
cool.
Like the smallest donation, giving it the smallest tier would unlock 50 new omnibuses for you to listen to today as you run your marathon or commute home from work or plot the destruction of the racist white race. Whatever you're doing, let Omnibus be your soundtrack.
And remember, the lowest tier is $50 a month.
The lowest tier, a mere $180 a month, and you'll get 50 new episodes. No, you can give it any amount. Thank you to our supporters. The show would not exist without you.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that this catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese. Hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.